Hi, I'm Bess Godin, and welcome to Millennial Splaining. So, I bet you're wondering, who is this bitch? Who died and made her the ultimate authority to speak for her entire generation? Well, the answer is, I'm nobody. I have no authority whatsoever. Like so many millennials, I was told to get an education. Then, I graduated into a barren and opportunity-less economy. We are the most overeducated and underemployed. The greatest minds of my generation go unheard. They are too busy serving coffee, flipping burgers, moving boxes, babysitting, and pumping gas to survive. All the while applying to better jobs that they are also overqualified for, but for which they know they'll never get an interview. And finally, at the end of a long day, we have time not to relax, but to work on our blogs and YouTube channels so we can have some modicum of expression in a world where we are told daily that we are disposable. And with each of these desperate efforts to grab hold of the national microphone, we find ourselves slipping further and further away from it because the world doesn't want to hear our problems. By corporate reinforced choice, we are a generation lost in obscurity. But even more importantly, hop on over to millensplain.com, where you can find my YouTube channel, my articles, and also other ways to support me. Please, 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 please consider donating to my Patreon, or donating to my Venmo, or buying some of my products on Redbubble, because I'm just poor, and I really don't want my landlord to show me the door. Thanks so much! Now enough of this bullshit. Let's get on to the episode. So, hi, Awkward. Thank you so much for joining me on Millennial Splaining.
Oh, thank you.
So, why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with activism and as a rapper? And I know that you started a is it a not-for-profit called 10 Demands?
Not formally a non-for-profit. We don't take any money at this point. There was a conversation early on about, you know, how we could fund certain things. You know, we initially got some anonymous donors, and that enabled us to give a nominal sum to the person who did our design work. But I would say 99% of that went into the creation and distribution of flyers on abolition that went to protesters on the streets across the country in 2020. Mm-hmm. The proceeds from the 10 Demands song that I did all went to the Movement for Black Lives. And at this point, you know, we're focused primarily on, education, as well as, targeting elected officials, to take action and any funds that are necessary, like website hosting, that kind of stuff just comes out of our pockets. We don't earn a profit. There is no profit in what we do, but we're not a formal nonprofit in the sense that we're not part of the nonprofit industrial complex.
Gotcha. Yeah, I didn't mean anything with that. I should have just said
No. But I appreciate the question. And my background is basically that I was raised by a feminist, leftist, activist, anti-war, social justice, environmental activist, mom. I grew up in a working class family that moved from New York to a really wealthy town in Connecticut to, you know, give us this good life. And that meant being surrounded by people that had a lot more money than us and tended to be Christians and conservatives. And as a Jew, I experienced a lot of anti-Semitism. And so combining what my mom was teaching me and joining her on protests and things like that, and watching the meetings she was hosting in our, the, you know, the organizing meetings she was hosting in our house, combined with what I was witnessing, and then realizing shortly, you know, pretty quickly that the experiences of the few people of color and the LGBTQ people where we lived were even worse than what I was experiencing as, you know, one of the few Jews, my radicalization happened very quickly. I was born into it and it just grew from there. My initial approach, because my initial response was anger. And the more I learned about what was happening from a national and international perspective, the more angry I was at the injustice and inequality. And so I walked around following in my cousin's footsteps. They co-founded the Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, and I just looked for Nazis to beat up. My mom, however, was a pacifist. I am not to this day, but needless to say, the calls from police and the, you know, the behavior itself was not something that she really approved of. So she helped me kind of transition into more productive avenues, instead of using violence, being productive, organizing like she was doing. And meanwhile, like listening to all the hippie music that was played in the house and the Motown music, and then the Public Enemy and NWA that my babysitter was playing, also had a really musical background. And there's something about the modern, more modern music, the rap music, that just connected with me. And so from the earliest stages, you know, I was making rap music, whether it was before I was recording, just writing it down. It was never about things that it wasn't me telling stories that I couldn't relate to, or mimicking things I was hearing on mainstream media or on, you know, on the radio or on MTV at the time. It was, if anything, following in the footsteps of Chuck D, who later co-signed my music. And so they went hand in hand from the beginning. My music and my activism were the same. My songs were used at protests. The songs are political statements, just like I feel like everything I do is a political statement.
Awesome. Yeah. And that's a beautiful way to live. And it's a beautiful way to be an artist, you know, absolutely. I love your music. Yeah, I mean, I kind of identify with you a little bit about your upbringing. I'm also Jewish. I also had liberal hippie parents. And yeah, I mean, my parents were very into music as well. I grew up with Motown, you know, as well as all the hippie dippy folk music as well. So, you know, I definitely identify with your upbringing a little bit there. Taking a minute, as a Jew, would you like to speak on the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's a lot more complex than the vast majority of people are willing to admit. There is extremism on both sides, and it's not at all debatable that what Israel is doing to Palestinian people is crimes against humanity. It is horrible oppression and violence, state violence. So whether I'm a Jew or not, as a humanist, as a leftist, as a person who is against war, I am obviously strongly in support of the Palestinian people. However, I think that, you know, there are just as many people on the left or in support of Palestinian people as there are the crazy lunatics on the right who are just pro-Israel and don't care about the Palestinians, who are unwilling to understand why Israel was created, or how Israel was created, or the other actors that have really facilitated the violence between the groups. You know, Jews and Muslims got along almost the entirety of the time for many generations, hundreds or thousands of years, whatever it is, in the Middle East before the Holocaust. Jews were victims of not just the Holocaust, but of pogroms. And
that's where my family came from. My family is from the border between Russia and Poland. So like sometimes you're Russia, sometimes you're Poland. And we came here in the 1910s during the pogroms. We are Fiddler on the Roof, essentially.
You know, I have some Russian and Polish Jew in me as well, but I'm also a Palestinian Jew. And I, you know, my grandma was born in Palestine. And, you know, I think that a lot of blame is put on Jews, and a lot of false equivalents are made between that all Jews are Israel and all Jews are Zionists, and the real homeland of all American Jews is Israel. Like, none of this is actually true. Jews always lived in the Middle East, and there's a reason there's this concept of the wandering Jew. It is something you can Google and see. That was not the choice of the Jewish people. That was the result of having to escape persecution over and over. So Jews wandered all over Eastern Europe and, you know, throughout the world, but always existed in the Middle East, in what is now considered Israel. And it was the British who facilitated the exodus post-Holocaust of survivors to Israel and began this process of, you know, othering and alienating and removing Palestinian people. And then from that point on, it was the United States leveraging Israel for its political and military purposes and financial purposes, to have this so-called democratic stronghold surrounded by, you know, their enemies. That's how they perceive them, in order to, you know, get as much oil as they could from the surrounding countries. There are a ton of Jews in Israel who are in full support of what Israel is doing, and I'm against all of them. But there's also a ton of Jews who live, who coexist with Palestinians, who live peacefully in neighborhoods with Palestinians, and are against what the Jewish state is doing.
As well as organizations that are against it in Israel.
Right. And the same can be said about American Jews. So I think, you know, it's certainly wrong to play the both sides-ism thing at this point and say, you know, Israel and the Palestinians are guilty. I always take the side of the oppressed, and Israel is the oppressor. So there's no debating that, but there's a total lack of understanding of the history, how we got to this point in the first place. And then for me personally, I'm against the concept of a nation state. I don't believe in arbitrary boundaries. I am not a pacifist when it comes to the oppressed using violence to end their oppression. I'm not against using violence if you witness someone raping someone else, but I am against wars, you know, leveraged from, you know, wars committed or started by one country, arbitrarily created against another country, or for the sake of religion, or any of these things that the people who are suffering as a result have no say in. So in an ideal world, we wouldn't have these arbitrary borders and nation states and no reason to be fighting over who owns what land and what they should be calling it. But that's not the world we currently live in. So as long as there is a state of Israel, I believe as long as there's a lot of other countries that surround it, Israel should also exist, but at the same time, not if there's not a Palestine. So I really do believe in the two-state solution, as long as we're going to have nation states. I don't have the answer, though, as just this one Jewish guy in the U.S., as to how we're going to make that work, how it's going to happen, because the people in power on both sides don't want the other to exist.
Right. Well, I think, you know, and I think it's important when we talk about this too, to bring up that, you know, at this point, like, yes, there are so many heated emotions. Yes, there are so many people that are invested in each of the, you know, in Judaism and Islam. But when it comes down to it, at this point, that's not what this conflict is about anymore. This is now about, you know, an American presence in the Middle East. And this is also about us, you know, selling our guns, right? That's another huge part of it. So, you know, we really need to think critically about that. And I absolutely agree that it's a complicated issue and that I'm not here to just blanket excuse or condemn anyone. But, you know, I absolutely agree that what's going on in the Gaza Strip is crimes against humanity. And I'm disgusted that anybody who calls themselves Jewish is perpetrating them. Honestly, it makes me sick, you know, that we experienced that oppression. And then we turned around and did it to other people the minute we had a chance. And that's not okay. It's not okay.
And if you read Kwame Nkrumah or Frantz Fanon or any of these other people, they will tell you that that is actually not uncommon. As a Jew, I'm right there with you. It's disgusting. It's devastating. And embarrassing. But this is actually commonplace that the... And that is what leads to some people that saying like humans are just bad by nature. Like we can't have anything good because we all suck. Because I don't agree with that, but it is a direction people can go from here, because unfortunately, time and time again, the people who take over from an oppressor end up following their footsteps and then doing similar things to what they were fighting against. And it's really unfortunate. And it's why it's so important that any revolutionary or liberatory movement be really strong in its ethics and its, strategies for post-liberation to prevent a repeat of the same thing.
Yeah, well said.
And also not, not consolidating all of the power in a very few. Like that's a huge part of it, is like people are corrupted by power. So power needs to be shared.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right about how, you know, people who experience that kind of oppression turn around and do it. It's very common because, you know, the other thing is too, like once you've like sort of arrived in a safety position, right? Like you could even say this about maybe like some of the Jews, at least in my area. I live in New Jersey. And there are a lot of Jews that have sort of concentrated in a couple of regions in Jersey that have, you know, are comfortable, have money, and they, you know, are very tight knit and they are, you know, very supportive of Israel, what they're doing in the Gaza Strip. And they, you know, it's important to point out that, you know, they sort of feel like entitled to it, right? Like their ancestor suffering has entitled them to go around and take what's theirs, right? And you know, like we cannot perpetuate that cycle, because that is the cycle that has been going on forever. That is the cycle that causes every war, and at some point it needs to stop. So yeah, for sure. Yeah. Anyway, so should we move on to the general strike?
Yeah, sure. It's something that I have been talking about since last April, the first intended date of May 1st. On May 1st, May Day, there were a lot of local actions and strikes that were successful. We saw positive results. On Juneteenth, there was a West Coast port shutdown that had a significant impact. Neither thing was a general strike. And the more you call for a general strike that doesn't happen, the weaker the term general strike becomes. It's like crying wolf. It took me a while to learn, and I'm constantly learning. One thing I knew all along is that I certainly didn't have the power or the platform to, on Twitter, convince the whole country to general strike. I was never that foolish. However, I was trying to build momentum toward that, and I wasn't the only one. So I thought, you know, if enough of us say it, maybe it'll happen. But that's just not how it works. And honestly, we don't want a general strike. So the reason we don't want a general strike is because it could very well mean a lot of people lose their jobs, and a lot more pressure is put on mutual aid groups, and, you know, charities and such, in the communities where people have lost their jobs. And, you know, it will increase homelessness. It could increase crime. It could increase, you know, police responses, which is typically targeting criminalized communities, brutalizing, beating, shooting, and arresting people. So that the potential dangers of a general strike are significant. And what we want to do instead is position ourselves so we can threaten a general strike. The other effect of a general strike is the corporations, the power holders, the economy shuts down. They lose millions and then billions of dollars. That is the positive effect of a general strike. When they see that they need us more than we need them, that's when we get our demands met. What we're hoping to do, though, is get to that point before we have to put ourselves at that risk. So what I've been working on over the last couple months, starting with a planning stage with Sarah Nelson, who, you know, is the head of the flight attendants union, and a huge labor organizer across the country, supports a lot of strikes and striking workers, and you know, as a speaker on this issue, on these issues, and now moving on to mutual aid and other related things, we are trying to build the groundwork, build the foundation so that we actually can threaten a general strike, and it will be a legitimate threat that they will fear, and they will respond, and they will meet our demands before we have to do it. And so, you know, in summarizing kind of what Sarah told us, you know, the first thing you need to do is identify the problems. That's probably the easiest thing. There are people starving. There are people without jobs. There are people working, you know, without a living wage. There are people who can't see a doctor, people who are going homeless, you know, becoming housing insecure, or, you know, becoming houseless and having to build a home in a place where they're going to be targeted by police, because there was no rent freeze, and, you know, a lot of very obvious problems. We need to fine tune, you know, or hone in on the specific problems that are universal enough that everyone is, you know, the vast majority of the poor and working class are affected by this problem. The next is determining then what solutions would address these problems. And this is where we come up with the demands. What demands need to be met so we can solve these problems? So a solution to lack of healthcare would be Medicare for all. A solution to people losing their homes or being evicted would be a rent and mortgage freeze. You know, a living wage would address people being underpaid. You know, jobs training and education could be a way to address, you know, people who don't have jobs. You know, another big thing would be taxing the corporations instead of the people, taxing the rich, taking that money and actually giving it to organizations that are providing services that people need to be emotionally well, to be physically well, addressing substance abuse and depression, things that are common results of poverty and things like that. From there, we need to come to an agreement about how far we're willing to go. You know, are we willing to general strike? For how long? And being clear and being certain that we have enough people who are willing to hit this extreme place if necessary. And the last part is getting support. We need enough of support from the public, enough people who are down to do this if necessary. And then we need support from the media, telling the story of what the demands are and why they are real and necessary, and how we are, and the fact that we are willing to do whatever is necessary to have those demands met, instead of focusing on, you know, the personalities of the leaders of the movement, or the people the media has decided are the leaders of the movement, instead of focusing on the tactics that striking workers may be choosing to put pressure on politicians and corporations, focusing on the demands and the reasons for those demands. Mm. When we are able to build that and then develop an infrastructure where if we general strike, people aren't going to starve, aren't going to die, we can make a legitimate threat of a general strike and have those demands met. And if those demands aren't met, we can general strike. So what we're focusing on right now is building that last part as well, the infrastructure. And there are mutual aid groups across this country. They are autonomous. They are community focused. They are, you know, community members know what their fellow community members need, and they are providing those resources, those services, that money, whatever it might be. It could be, you know, there's a water shortage. It could be there's a healthcare shortage. It could be there's a food shortage. What, you know, and I know that Ground Game LA put together a digital map that allows people looking for mutual aid to find mutual aid groups in their area. I'm still waiting to find out from them if the last time it was updated and how often it's updated. But what we're looking to do is kind of expand upon that and build a similar digital platform that would connect the mutual aid groups, so that organizations like Socialist Rifle Association that are working on logistics and things like that can support more mutual aid groups. They can be in touch with each other to share resources, to share ideas. If someone is traveling from one place in the country to another and wants to connect with a mutual aid group while they're there, they can do that through this networking tool. So we're not trying to develop some top-down hierarchical structure where there's, you know, a mutual aid organization with leaders telling local organizations what to do. It's the opposite of that. It's more just a loose-based, you know, a loosely connected collection of mutual aid groups that are all on equal footing that work together and take advantage as best they can of larger organizations that are offering things like, you know, trailers or crates with food, you know, things that the smaller local groups don't have access to. So that's where we're at now. We've started a mutual aid working group within the larger general strike group. So we're going to focus on that for now. And again, you know, that's open. You know, we want more people who have a mutual aid background to get involved. We need web developers to help create this. We're hoping that when we get to a point where we can, you know, start talking realistically about a general strike again, we're not really crying wolf anymore. It's real.
Yes, that's so important. That's so important. And even if we don't get to the point where we get to a general strike, we've still done of all this wonderful work helping people that really need it, right?
And we don't want a general strike. We will do it if we have to, if they make us. But
right.
We're going to do all this stuff in the meantime. And to your point, yeah, it's like, it's a win-win either way, right. You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's definitely going to take a lot of thinking on our part, on my part too. I'm with you guys. I'm in the group. and I'm dedicated to making that happen. But you know, it's difficult to sort of, and I feel like the Occupy Wall Street movement came up against this. It's difficult to sort of ask everyone for everything, right? I mean, that's not exactly an actionable thing. Like if we ask one, you know, are we asking the government for stuff? Are we asking a corporation for stuff? Are we asking, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, that's going to take a lot of groupthink on our part to come up with a little bit more specific, agenda, because it's very easy to be frustrated, right? I mean, it's very easy to be frustrated, all the problems, and to say like, I want to do something about everything, you know? But at the same time, like, that's not, you know, looking at it from the corporate side, from the government side, if you don't have any one specific person that you're yelling at, then it's very easy for them to go, well, that's his fault. I'm with you guys, you know? And that's essentially what happened during Occupy Wall Street. You know, some of the politicians came out in support of it, but then didn't do anything in the government, which we were asking to. So, you know, that's something we need to consider as well, that, you know, we really need to come up with, like, you know, these banks need to pay this much in taxes every year, or this, you know, comes very specific actionable demands, because it's they're looking for every excuse, right, to weasel out of this. They're looking for every excuse. And as we've seen too, with recently with AOC and Bernie, about how, you know, they went to the McDonald's $15 an hour strike recently, and they were in support of it. And then AOC put out a video after the fact saying, like, this is what we need you guys to do. Like, we need to be able to point to your organizing to give us the power to do something, and blah, 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 blah. Like, people had been organizing for what, 10 years now for $15 minimum wage, when it should be $25 at this point. So what are you talking about, AOC? What are you talking about? You know, so I mean, if we were to have a general strike soonish, my suggestion would be to have it at the Progressive Caucus, because they're the people that are failing us right now. But that's just an idea. I know it would be hard to like band the left together to do that, because some people are still in support of them very hardcore. And that's still a conversation we're having here. But, you know, just throwing out ideas.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so a couple thoughts, like, or a few thoughts. Like, one, we're just a small group, and we are a diverse group, economically and racially and all of that. But I, you know, a big question that I have is, when we get there, who decides what the demands are? And how do we make sure that, you know, there's equity in the decision making, and that the groups, the communities that are most directly impacted are the ones most directly involved in making those demands? That's one thing. And you know, also, it's worth noting that a general strike is not a political, it's not a leftist movement. It's a poor people's and working people's movement. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have to be able to, you know, but right now this group, we're all leftists, right? So we need to be able to persuade any working class or poor people who may not already feel what we're saying, that, you know, we're not doing this to achieve leftist goals. We're doing this to help the 99% mm-hmm. and hold the 1% responsible, no matter mm-hmm. what political party you're from, or, you know, what part of the country you live in. We all have one thing in common, and that's that we're working way too hard for way too little.
Right.
And, you know, and then the last part I would say is that we I think need to change laws. And so our main target does need to be the government, but the way to get the government to act, since they clearly don't have our best interests in mind, is to force the people they are interested in listening to, which is the CEOs and the corporations that are considered people also in this bizarre country.
Right.
We have to get them to tell the government to listen to us. And the only way we're going to do that is with the threat that none of us are going to go to work. Mm-hmm. all of your, you know, your assembly lines, your offices, everything's going to shut down if you don't tell the government on our behalf that they need to listen to us. And mm-hmm. yeah, it might mean that you, God forbid, have to pay taxes like we do. But if you don't, you won't have any business to pay taxes on.
Right. Right. I mean, and that brings up a great point too. Like, yes, well, you know, I forget what the law is exactly that proclaims companies legally as a person, but that's the reality. But if you think about what companies actually are, they're not, they're a collective, right? Like their own little government in essence, right? I mean, that's how they formed. And you represent the well-being of all the people within your purview and within your employ. And, you know, I am very much for socializing, you know, corporate businesses and the private industry. And I definitely think that this is an idea that people need to start thinking about more critically as well. We need to treat our bosses like our government officials, that they owe us stuff. They owe us stuff because we are contributing to their well-being as well.
Yep. And that is definitely one of the demands I'd like to see, which is worker ownership of the businesses themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to see that. And that's going to be a huge battle because that's hitting them where it hurts, right? For sure. Well, absolutely. Well, I 3,000,000% encourage everyone who has even, you know, a little bit, a general strike inside them somewhere to come join us and help us make this a reality. I encourage, you know, artists and filmmakers to come, you know, join us and document this process. We need to get the word out about this and get everyone's heads together on how to make this possible. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. And thank you for joining us, for putting in this work, and for your entire career of activism. I mean, you're awesome. You're awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And, you know, I'll just say that, you know, a lot of people know me as, if they don't know me as the music guy, they or the rapper, they know me as the abolitionist. And it's worth noting that the general strike and the mutual aid and all of that stuff is directly related to the war machine and to domestic terrorism by the white supremacist institution of policing and mass incarceration. Mutual aid and harm reduction and alternative methods of keeping us safe and healthy, that is all what we would need to ensure exists to enable a general strike. And it is also the abolitionist vision of the alternatives to policing and mass incarceration. Yes. And when we defund the police, we should also be defunding the Pentagon. All of this money that is going into imperialism domestically and outside across the world, this money could be spent to feed and house and, you know, provide health care to the, you know, the 40 million people who go hungry every night, you know, or the 2.5 million people in detention across the country.
Absolutely. 300%. 300%. I mean, yeah. And it's so important that we call it abolition, right? I mean, yes, defund the police, but also abolish prisons, because it's literally slavery. And we need to use that term very specifically. It is literally slavery. We need to abolish it. So absolutely. I agree. Yes, for sure. All right. Well, are there any final thoughts that we covered a lot of ground today?
Yeah, for sure. you know, I would say, you know, my name is Awkward Rap, AWKWORDRAP on Twitter. My DMs are open. So that's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me if you want to support the 10 Demands organization, our abolitionist group, or if you want to get engaged regarding the general strike or our mutual aid efforts. Our website for 10 for Justice is 10forjustice.com. And you could also reach me at thisisawkward.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll make it a regular thing. This has been great.
Thank you so much.
All right. All right. Bye.